Junior partner, man?
What, go ahead.
Are you under partner?
We ready, Kirby?
Yes.
We're recording? All right, we're gonna call our regular complaints committee meeting to order. Again, we'll go around the room to say who's here. We'll start with Kirby.
Kirby Oberdorfer, Office of Ethics Compliance and Oversight.
Oh, Carl Miller, Ethics Director.
Ellen Schmidt, Ethics Commission appointee.
Brian Hall, Ethics Commission.
John Hartley, Ethics Commission.
Joseph Rogan, Ethics Commission.
Juana?
Juana Allen, Chair.
Hello, Juana.
Hey.
Okay, for, on new business today, we had the proposed amendments to the Ethics Commission complaint procedure. And I think Joe had looked at this, so I'm gonna turn this over to him to see what he's done so far.
Sure. So we talked about last time, I had hoped and have some large-scale thoughts I wanted to talk about today. I have, with a, looked at some specific revisions, gone over those with Carla and Kirby and got some initial feedback and stuff that I'll go back and reincorporate. But really, the main thing that we should talk about is what is the structure of a complaint, of the adjudication of a complaint going to look like going forward? Coming from South Florida, I believe it was West Palm. Was it West Palm? So in West Palm, they had a complaint that it was their first one. We've never had one, the history here that I found out. We have never had a complaint pass even the probable cause determination, let alone go to a final public hearing. And so this would be, if we found probable cause, what would the adjudication process look like? Under the current code, it would be in front of the full Ethics Commission, and even evidentiary objections would have to be ruled on by the full Ethics Commission. And so somebody would have to move to overrule the objection, and that would have a second and discussion and, you know, carry or not. And that would be crazy. It just wouldn't work. And West Palm figured this out recently because they had a complaint. And Carla, do you want to give a little bit of background to that one so they can understand the context?
Yeah, West Palm Beach had a complaint. And their Ethics Commission processes a lot of complaints, but rarely do they get past probable cause. This one case where they did was someone giving a campaign contribution to an elected official and not reporting themselves as a lobbyist. And then when they found out, they reported. I mean, it was a very minor little thing that probably what our commission would have done would have just been send them an advice letter or something and be done with it. The person who was accused of this was a billionaire horsewoman, and she didn't like being, you know, going through this process, so she hired lawyers. She went through this whole commission proceeding, and you can imagine they have 9 commissioners, I believe, in West Palm Beach. So this hearing went on for maybe 2 or 3 months, and so they come January, and it'd be like 6 of the 9 members. Then the next month it'd be a different group of people. And, you know,
sorry.
So what they, the lawyers objected to just the entire procedure, that the people that found probable cause to begin with were also the ones that were sitting around and adjudicating the merits of the case. They contested the tape recording of the meeting, that it had been altered, and they brought in an expert that spent like $30,000, $40,000 examining the Ethics Commission machine and the tapes. And, you know, it went on for about a year, which led to Senator Abruzzo in Tallahassee asking the state audit committee to audit the Palm Beach County Ethics Commission.
Wow.
And it went on for about a year and a half. Now, what I thought was interesting was Senator Abruzzo was on this woman's payroll as an advisor to the tune of over $150,000 that didn't show up on his financial disclosure forms. But that was pretty interesting. It was the example of everything that could go wrong in an Ethics Commission hearing. And so I thought it was a tremendous example of what can go wrong and what we can do to prevent that kind of thing from happening. And so now they're just fairly quiet down in Palm Beach County, and they do not want to try any cases, they would give it to an administrative hearing judge to do. They backed off, I think, significantly. I don't think they've had any hearings since. It was a debacle and a national example of what can go wrong with an ethics commission. So that's the background. And they came up with some procedures that I think are illustrative. And anyhow, that's background, and I passed on their procedures and what they've tried to do to rehabilitate their credibility. But once you have something like that happen, it's right. It'll take them a decade to come back from that.
So the two things that I wanted to discuss and see if we had thoughts generally, the first is, how do we adjudicate these? One way we could potentially change it from the way it is right now is to have a process that mirrors the Florida Election Commission's process. Essentially, you can request an informal hearing before the commission, and in that case, you come before like a regular meeting, or it could be a specially set meeting, and you'd have, you know, a half hour, however long the chair would set, to talk, and then the commission would make a decision. But if you want an adversarial full evidentiary hearing, then that goes to an administrative law judge. Now, I don't know whether I would suspect we cannot send things to the Florida Department of Administrative Hearings, but what we could do is appoint a hearing officer, either from OGC or otherwise, a retired judge who volunteered to spend the time and do it, could appoint a hearing officer to hear the case. And so that's the first part of it. As a part B to that, if any of you know how the Judicial Qualifications Commission works, which is the body that hears complaints, ethical complaints against judges, they realized several years back that there was a problem having the same investigative body who was investigating, finding facts, and determining probable cause also make up, in our case, just about half of the ultimate decision-making body. So they split into what the way the JQC does it now is you have an investigative panel and a hearing panel. And really, it's just the JQC, and they take a certain number of them, they point them to the investigative panel, the rest of them are the hearing panel. And the way we could do that here, if that was something we were interested in doing, is the complaints committee, rather than submitting a recommendation of probable cause to the full commission, could find probable cause. And basically, the remaining members of the commission would then be the hearing panel. And that would also avoid what I think is an apparent conflict. I don't think it's a true conflict of interest, but what's an apparent conflict of all of us being the ones directing an investigation and, you know, having either appointing, you know, John or somebody else to be our investigator, or Carla, who then finds facts, comes back to us, and we find probable cause. And then now we're supposed to be putting all that out of our mind and now sitting on a panel and saying, pretending like we've never heard this before. So those are really the two things. So the first is the people, and I guess I did them in flipped order. The first is the same people who sit on the investigative panel ultimately sitting on the final panel. And then the second is, what does that final hearing look like? And so those combined are kind of what I wanted to talk about.
And as a follow-up to what you said, I did check with general counsel at one point about using attorneys in OGC to be the hearing officers if we ever got to that point. And it's not likely, we haven't done it in 20 years, it's not likely we're going to all of a sudden start having hearings like this, because usually things drop out prior to that time. But if we did, they have trained hearing officers in OGC that we could just say, okay, your hearing officer doesn't cost any money to the city for us to use you, or we could get a volunteer judge. You know, we could deal with that at the time. And so I think that's a good idea for us not to be the final. But then, like, let's say you have an administrative law judge or a hearing officer, and they come up with findings of facts and recommendations for disposition of the case. It comes back to the commission, just like at the state level, for final approval. And so you can, you know, tinker with the findings or with the penalty. And all I would additionally add is, when the cases come in at the front end, that's where we really need to think with what kind of stuff comes in the front end. The tail end, yes, for the one case out of 100 that we actually go through a hearing, that's good to have that nailed down. The front end, we get a lot of cases that clearly, when you review the complaint, they're just not going to pan out. Do you know what I mean? I'm wondering, like a speedier disposition.
Well, Carl, if you wouldn't mind, let's talk about this one first. So the second issue is this addition of that I have is kind of the addition of an ethics officer review, which would allow Carla to dismiss complaints subject to review by the complaints committee. So that's kind of a separate issue. But first, let's talk about the composition of the final hearing and whether in this process for splitting up the basically investigative and hearing panels.
There's ethics commissions around the country that do it that way, and it's considered that if you're not huge, like New York or Miami with a lot of resources, that if you split the ethics commission into two, the investigative and the adjudicatory, or the hearing panel, that that's the best way to do it. So, I mean, there's precedent for it around the country.
I think it's a good idea.
And then, so I guess the first step is the splitting of, into an investigative body and an adjudicatory, what was the word you used, Colin?
It's a big one, though.
Adjudicative body?
Yeah.
What do you guys think about that? Is that?
I mean, I guess my first comment was I agree with you that it's more the appearance
right.
of impropriety. I mean, criminal judges do this every day.
Of course.
They determine mm-hmm. probable cause at their first hearing, and then they adjudicate the case
right.
after a trial. So
yeah.
I don't really think there's a fundamental problem with having a subset of the larger body
mm-hmm.
make the determination. But, you know, the flip side of it is that the judge is just weighing whatever's presented to the court for probable cause hearing. The sheriff's office makes the initial determination of whether there's probable cause to make an arrest. So if we're kind of commingling those
which is what we're doing.
Functions.
Yeah. Now, in this complaint procedures now, it actually says if one of the commissioners becomes the investigator,
mm-hmm.
that he should recuse himself
right.
from the vote.
Yes.
So, I mean, they kind of already addressed that. So even if you took the whole complaint committee and did what this is actually asking you to do, then you
right.
would be doing what you said.
There's a mechanism absolutely for avoiding an actual. I don't think there is an actual conflict. It's the appearance, and a strong enough appearance that both the Florida Judicial Qualifications Commission and the Florida Election Commission thought that it was a big enough appearance of a conflict that it was worth splitting up the two bodies.
Well, what's the downside? I mean, there's
the downside just to trying to be fair. I think it's a good idea, but to try to get the other argument. The downside is you do need the full adjudicatory body there, and so in that one case in the ever where you would actually have a full hearing before an administrative officer of some sort, and then you'd have de novo review by the adjudicatory body of the ethics commission, you need everybody there.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was a matter that required an extended amount of time before the commission, it may be difficult just as a scheduling matter. And that was something that West Palm Beach learned because they tried to do this two-week hearing. I think it was two-week right, trial. But some people were there one day and then weren't there the next day, and others were there the next day. And so people were hearing different evidence, and then everybody made the final determination.
Yeah, it was bad.
And so you can't do that, obviously.
No.
But that's just to try to play.
But again, in terms of if we're splitting roles, then the only folks that would need to be present for the hearing would be those that are going to adjudicate.
Exactly.
Right? You wouldn't need the full body, so actually it would be less burdensome.
I think that's right.
There would be fewer people. So I guess maybe the risk is just that you're bestowing that much more responsibility on the individuals that are going to make that adjudication decision.
And the way it works, and we could think about, if everybody agreed with this idea, we could think about the mechanics. The way it works on the JQC, I have no idea how it works on the Elections Commission, but on the JQC, is there has to be a certain number of people on the hearing panel, and if somebody's conflicted out either because of recusal or just scheduling conflicts, then the chair, or actually I believe it's the governor for the JQC, appoints just an ad hoc member who sits on the body just to make sure that you have enough people. So if you ended up with a recusal and a scheduling conflict, you may not want three people deciding, ultimately making the final hearing. You may want more than that. And so we could talk about the mechanics if everybody kind of agreed with the idea.
And you could always have flexibility with the chair could say that the complaints committee will be comprised of these three people for this complaint. And then you have more people that are left to, adjudicate it if it gets to that mm-hmm. stage. So there could be flexibility on it, but splitting it up so we don't hear the case from the very beginning to the very end and have all the same people deciding everything. That procedure that we have in our rules, which was copied, I think, from Miami's Ethics Commission, and they have since changed it, doesn't follow any logical procedure that I can find in any other commission. So splitting it up is a good first step.
Okay. Everybody.
Just from a scheduling standpoint, and your responsibilities end, and another person's responsibilities begin, and You don't have?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
And okay. Since most of them are handled at the front end, and they very rarely get to this point where we're going to have to get an administrative law judge or a hearing officer to do it, we need to have it in place for that one case, like when we had the case against the mayor.
Well, but we're not at that second part yet, right? Because I have some more questions about that.
Right. So now the next. So do you have any questions? Or are you good on that general part, Ellen, of splitting the of having?
Yeah, I think it makes sense to me.
Okay.
And the four of us or a subset of us would be the people who do the initial investigatory part and then refer it on to our colleagues.
Yeah, and if there was some special, like Carla was saying, if some matter came in where our chair, you know, Yvonne or whoever it was at the time, thought that it was this is a case where it's going to create conflicts, right? If they filed a complaint against, I'm not even sure if this would fall under jurisdiction, but if somebody filed a complaint against Kirby or somebody in our office, then Yvonne could pull people off the investigative body to make sure that we had more people for the final adjudication. So you only had three, and then you had six available for final. And then the next part of it, I think, is what Carla was just getting to, is what then does that final hearing look like? And my thought was that it could be, I like the way the Elections Commission does it, where you can either do an informal hearing, which is basically you come and say what you want for whatever time the chair gives you in front of the full commission, and you accept whatever comes out of that, or you can offer for the full evidentiary hearing, which will then go to whoever the hearing panel appoints, which could be an OGC hearing officer, it could be a volunteer judge.
Why does it need to be someone who's going to cost additional money? Why wouldn't it still be us?
Could be.
It could be.
Could be, yeah.
If Yvonne wanted to appoint herself or... an attorney who was on the commission or anybody. It would basically be whoever the chair wanted.
But I mean, does it need to be, I'm kind of likening this to like a magistrate judge and then the commission is kind of a district judge when there's a recommendation? Yeah. Does there have to be that extra step or could the commission just hear the evidence and make a decision?
Well, if it was going to be a short enough case where it wouldn't be impractical, then you could have the commission do it. That does get complicated. I made some revisions to the complaint procedures having that in mind, where like evidentiary objections would be handled by the presiding officer, which generally would be the chair, unless the chair didn't know anything about the rules of evidence and wanted to let somebody else be the presiding officer.
Well, and that's...
That way you don't have to have a motion on every evidentiary.
Is a certain evidence code adopted by our rules?
Certain parts of the rules of evidence are adopted. So the rules of evidence do not generally apply to the procedure, but there are certain things that do. The hearsay rules are, I believe, if I recall, Kirby, since she wrote them, could probably correct me if I'm wrong, but some of the hearsay rules apply if it's a sufficiently untrustworthy statement, then the commission could vote to exclude the evidence. So the commission could, but the procedure would not require it to go to a hearing officer. But if something came in, like the West Palm case, where you're talking about a two-week evidentiary trial, there's no way. You just couldn't. That has to go to a hearing officer.
And that's why they have options in Palm Beach. They didn't say, from this point forward, we're only going to do it one way. They said this group that split off from the Ethics Commission, the group of five could hear it. It could go to a volunteer. It could go to an administrative law judge. It could go to a hearing officer. But you make the choice at some point in the case of, if the person wants to pursue all the way to the end, which of these five options are you going to pick for them to go on? And it just gives us more options. Because on the case that we had against the mayor, it would have been really good to have an administrative law judge hear that. Do you know what I mean? Then people feel like there's more due process. They feel safer instead of like, volunteers, some lawyers, some not, and they're going to hear the evidence, and that doesn't give people a lot of confidence.
Well, we know that the main thing is that you have something like this, because common sense gets thrown out the window when something like this happens, so you got to have it in writing and at least have those rules so that we can have something to refer to that this has been thought of and well thought of and not at the time of the crisis, so...
And maybe what would alleviate your concern, Brian, is if instead of it being the respondent's choice, you could have that the hearing panel would vote whether to refer it to a hearing officer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that would be a little, that's okay to be different from the Elections Commission, just be a little bit different. The Elections Commission, it's the option of the respondent. they can choose whether to be in a quorum. But I think what you're suggesting, which I would be fine with me, is that the five-member, however many member hearing panel would decide if they wanted to refer it.
That's
well,
the best
just
way.
Just in terms of not, you know, the concern is, are we creating something that may necessarily create a whole bunch of expense for the city in the future when it would be an option that would be less expensive?
Well, this, we're talking about somebody who would be free, right? Or would we,
yeah.
I guess, would we
yeah.
get internally charged from OGC?
No, if we use OGC, there should not be a charge. Last time I talked to them about it. And if there was a charge, then we can certainly get a retired judge to come in and do it. We can find an option for
right.
that won't cost the city much. And if it's once every couple of years that we would need that, then it's just an expense that the city would have to bear. You know, there was a proposed state law by Senator Abruzzo right after the Palm Beach County thing happened to regulate all ethics commissions in the state. And a respondent in a case could demand an administrative law judge or hearing officer. It was totally in their hands as to what they wanted to pick for their hearing officer. And the ethics commissions around the state opposed that and said, no, it should be the option of the ethics commission.
Right.
On you know, the level of importance of this case or complexity on who we're going to refer to and what our budget is. You know, so you'd have the option.
So you could still basically give them the choice of formal or informal hearing. And if it was informal, it would go to the hearing panel for a one-hour meeting, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And if they picked formal, then the hearing panel could decide, do we want to hear this? Do we think it's going to be just a four-hour trial where, you know, everybody's on board and we'll do it? Or is this going to be sufficiently complicated where
mm-hmm.
we need a professional adjudicator to come in and do it? And I haven't asked anybody, but I imagine we could find a retired judge or somebody who wouldn't mind adding to their CV that they've been the hearing officer for the Jacksonville Ethics Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And if we couldn't, then we'd just have to bear the, we'd either have to appoint a member
yeah.
of the commission
or OGC.
For OGC.
When something like this plays out, if this case were sufficient to come through this process, would the fireman, the lieutenant you were talking about, be the person who appeared, or would we actually see the complainant?
So the way it works is, and if you read through it, the way it works now is
mm-hmm.
that you have an investigator appointed, and if there's a probable cause finding, the commission, or I guess as amended, it would be the hearing panel, appoints an advocate, which is essentially a prosecutor.
Okay.
And an advocate is probably, we're probably not calling it what it should be. You know, it's a...
Sounds like the opposite
yeah,
of an advocate.
Right. I mean, most of the panels, like the JQC calls it special counsel.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's that's your prosecutor. So there's a prosecutor assigned. The respondent can have a counsel if they want, or they can appear on their own. My understanding, although Kirby or Carla could correct me, is that once the probable cause finding is made, the complainant's rights are pretty limited. At that point, it really becomes the commission.
I understand.
So the complainant doesn't have, I mean, they are under our rules, they're noticed at each stage,
mm-hmm.
but they don't have a right to like withdraw their complaint unilaterally
mm-hmm.
after a probable cause determination. They can request that the commission dismiss the complaint. But that was is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Not unlike the victim of a
crime.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Once it's reported, it's out of their hands.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay.
So
do we have to vote on that, or is that just gonna be moved? That's a motion.
No, there was a motion.
Yeah, well, I didn't have a motion.
I just
want to get everybody's thoughts. If everybody agrees with this stuff, then I will go back and create a proposed revision that I'll work with Carla.
So you don't have a draft yet.
I don't have a draft that I'm ready to propose to everybody yet.
Sure.
And this is just concept?
Right, this is concept. So there's those two, and if we're on the page for those two, if we have time, one other thought I wanted to run by you guys, and then so those two sound right, is everybody? I think we're good there.
Yeah, definitely
seems
worth consideration. Especially,
yeah.
I don't see a downside with separating.
Yeah.
The first prong.
Sherry, do you have any thoughts on that? On those two?
No, I don't. I'll just wait to see what you bring back.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
Yeah, of course.
And then I probably would have some thoughts.
Yeah.
Then. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. Thank you.
And then the last thing is putting in some process. And Carla had this idea, and I think she's absolutely right. Some process for there to be a preliminary determination that can be made by the ethics director. And this is just a working concept. I don't necessarily have a, you know, a proposal yet, but a thought I had was that if something is going to be outside the jurisdiction of the Ethics Commission, or it looks like it's going to be, so the lieutenant would be a good example,
mm-hmm.
because if there isn't an allegation that he misused his position to get there, right, then it's a question. So is there, is it legally sufficient or not? The other would be a statute of limitations. So it's legally sufficient, but you can tell based on the allegations that everything occurred more outside the statute of limitations. So in those instances where it looks like the Ethics Commission won't have jurisdiction, mm-hmm. Carla can dismiss it, or the ethics director could dismiss it. And that dismissal can be reviewed. The complainant can seek for review before the complaints committee if they want.
Isn't this very similar to what we already have? The only difference being
so there's a process right now for technical. So and it's actually there's an ambiguity in the rules right now because it says under the technical review on the review for technical purposes it has a reference to statute of limitations, but statute of limitations is not a technical deficiency; it's a jurisdictional deficiency, which would fall under Rule 12 instead of Rule 6, I believe. Or I may be flipping that. But in essence, it would allow the revision would allow Carla to review either where it looks like there's no jurisdiction, like our lieutenant, or like 2017-01, where it looks like there isn't going to be jurisdiction, or where it's clear there's a statute of limitations problem. So in those two instances, it would add where Carla is able, or the ethics director is able to dismiss the complaint and the complainant within 30 or however long we decide ultimately.
Normally what Carla does is bring it to us.
Right.
And she
it has to go through us and through the full commission.
Which takes time.
Right. So in this case, we've already assumed under the first concept I brought up that it's just the complaints committee, assuming everybody, the full commission obviously would have to adopt these changes. Mm-hmm. But if they did, it would be the complaints committee that would decide there's no probable cause, and there'd be no review of that.
Mm-hmm.
So the full commission, if there's no probable cause found by the complaints committee, the full commission would never see the complaint. They could, because it would be public record, but, it would never be brought before them for a decision. And this would add another element of that to say if there's no jurisdiction, most of the time it will be a statute of limitations, question of statute of limitations. Carla can dismiss it subject to review by the complaints committee.
And at the September meeting in 2016, Carla discussed this procedure because sometimes it's more efficient to bring it to the entire commission as opposed to parsing it out to the complaints committee and then having you all sit through it again in the full commission and in the shade. And what the commission decided at the September meeting was that Carla could have the discretion and consultation with the chair of the complaints committee and the chair of the ethics commission to figure out what might be the best procedure on a case-by-case basis, but that has not been memorialized in the complaint procedure.
And see, if we had a procedure where if it clearly is something that we're going to end up dismissing, it's pretty clear,
mm-hmm.
To have to go to this committee and then to go to the full commission is duplicating a lot of effort. And so that's why some of them we've just bypassed this committee and gone mm-hmm. straight to the ethics commission, so we don't have two. But if this commission or committee was given the authority to take a look at it and your word is final on those particular things, that's good. I don't necessarily, unless it's statute of limitations, if it's legal sufficiency, you may want to chew on it. But I think that your decision should be the final one at that point. And then they can appeal it to the entire commission 30 days later if they're not happy with that. I don't want to be the sole deciding person on legal sufficiency. Statute of limitations, this happened 10 years ago. I mean, that may be something. But even that is something that I could come here and say, here's my recommendation. You need to dismiss it, but it should stop here. We shouldn't have dual meetings.
Carly, didn't we talk about that you had the authority to at least do some of the preliminary, because before you weren't doing it, you couldn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to come and bring it before the committee, and then we could say, all right, Carly, we need this or that or the other, when really at least that was my interpretation at the time, was that it would give you some authority from this committee to do some of the legwork before it came here.
We had a question about this
I think the rules say that. I've read them. I think it does say that you have the authority to do some investigating before it comes to us.
Kirby has had a reading that, I think in Kirby's view, that's ambiguous. What you brought to me, Kirby, is to say that it was a little bit unclear whether the ethics office could investigate without a direction from them.
Right. So I thought at the time that's what they were asking us for, was right. that ability
but this
to do
would,
that.
Essentially, this my proposal would eliminate that issue.
Yeah.
Because the ultimate decision maker up to probable cause would be the complaints committee.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you would never have this issue. It wouldn't matter because Carla could easily go to the complaints committee or the complaints committee chair and say, I want to go try this, this, and this. And he or she could say, go for it or no.
Well, maybe it's just to keep the initial plan flexible with right. approval from the chair of the complaints committee. If it's like this happened 15 years ago, I'm not going to do anything with it except bring it to the next meeting so you can officially dismiss it. Yeah, that's fine. Or this one looks like if we just did A, B, and C with the investigation, we could figure out if there's something here or not. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like just to give the option for the ethics director to meet or to confer with the chair of the complaints committee who can approve of a plan. Mm-hmm. If it's not a regular case going through the system, they can approve of an alternate plan.
So it sounds like what you're saying is if the decision to dismiss the complaint pre-probable cause was made by the complaints committee, then you wouldn't need authority to dismiss it,
right.
a complaint.
Right, right. It'll be easy. Okay. It'll be like one meeting, we dismiss it, and that's the final word. I just don't have to then take it to the entire commission, which is really, you know, it's not
unless
efficient.
Unless there's an appeal.
Hmm?
Unless there's an appeal.
Unless there's an appeal. Unless there's an appeal.
Yeah. And my thought would be, and this isn't something I thought about in depth, but my thought would be that there wouldn't be an appeal of that. Because the investigative panel is the one who has the discretion to say, we don't want to go forward with this. It wouldn't go to the full commission because otherwise we have the same problem with the investigative panel and the full panel saying that basically the full panel would say you should have continued with this, but we're all going to be unbiased when we hear this when it comes back to us.
Mm-hmm.
So the full committee would only hear a complaint, would only see a complaint if there was a finding of probable cause.
See, now
it actually wouldn't be a full committee anymore, right? It'd be the hearing.
So if Carla was acting as investigator and gathering this evidence and the subcommittee, the complaints committee, made a probable cause determination, I mean, it would seem to me that this separation of investigation and adjudication could be severed there to where there wouldn't be any kind of conflict if it was appealed. But I guess just the fact that it's appealed makes it
apparent.
Yeah.
So that's why my proposal under everything we've talked about here is that you really would have two separate panels. There isn't an appeal. The investigative panel or the complaints committee's job is to determine if there's probable cause or if there's another permissible reason to dismiss, like Rule 17 or Rule 6, I think it is, which is jurisdiction, like statute of limitations. So that would be fully within their discretion. And then once a probable cause finding is made, they're done. It's now the hearing panel. And so it's up to the hearing panel.
It's a reapplication of the same
yeah.
procedure.
Yeah.
And so if the complaint committee dismisses something, now if it's just not legally sufficient, happened 10 years, we're dismissing it. Does the respondent have any recourse? Like, I would think if you'd send them a letter saying this was dismissed, you've got 30 days to appeal to the entire commission, the other part of the commission. Almost a lot of those people just go ahead and do that, so we've still created a double procedure.
Yeah.
I thought in here in the rules somewhere we had that the final decision of the Ethics Commission is appealable to the circuit court. Isn't that
That's correct.
Yeah.
Well, it's if they have a right under the law to do that. I don't think that right is created in the Ethics Code.
Mm-hmm.
I think it says that and every agency has this. If you go to JEA procurement, every agency, there's something in there that says you have whatever common law rights you have, which generally is to petition for writ of certiorari in the circuit court. So
I think the code may state otherwise. I think the actual ordinance code says you have a right to appeal a finding.
Yeah, it does.
In a quasi-judicial proceeding. What's the section, Cherry?
It's 602.941. Any final order of the commission proposes civil penalties, major costs, or attorney's fees may be reviewed by the circuit court in such manner as is authorized for review of quasi-judicial
right.
board.
All right,
decisions.
So
can you give me that section again?
609.941.
609?
602.
I'm sorry, 602. Thank you. 602.941, entitled Review.
Yeah, but that seems to imply that there has to be a fine or some kind of penalty.
Yeah, there wouldn't be. You couldn't use that section to appeal
no.
a finding of dismissal.
Right.
No. Where there's a final determination that's going to
yes.
impact the respondent in some way.
The
it doesn't
respondent.
Have to be right. It doesn't have to be monetary. It could be a censure or something like that. But yes.
Right.
But under my thought, and I don't have a proposal yet, so I just want to get everybody's view. My thought was that the probable cause finding or a Rule 17 finding, like we did, like we have and or will or have we recommended, that finding would be is not appealable to anybody. The complaints committee would say we're dismissing this under Rule 17, or we're dismissing this because we don't have jurisdiction under Rule 6 or 12 or whatever it is. It's over. Mm-hmm. Unless they have some common law right to seek certiorari in the circuit court. But basically, the way I would change the rules would be that that would constitute final action of the ethics commission, is what it would say. Mm-hmm. The complaints committee's decision to dismiss a complaint for any reason prior to a probable cause finding would constitute final action of the ethics commission.
And that would be good because most of these over the years have been very, very clear that they should not go on any further on mm-hmm. statute of limitations right. or just... I mean, there's a myriad of...
And you could find that to be acceptable under this current appellate scheme because no one's rights are being adversely affected. I mean,
right.
it's just it's like a finding of not guilty. It's, you're okay, we're not going to proceed.
Uh-huh.
I mean...
Uh-huh. Right.
The complaining
really
party would be upset.
You want to have an appeal, but you don't really want to have an appeal when there's been a determination that there is no jurisdiction and you can't proceed.
Mm. The only person that would be upset is someone that is the complaining party, and this was their forum, and they wanted to get us to hear it, and we said, I'm sorry, you know, it happened 10 years ago. You know, you're out of here. They don't have any right to appeal anything.
And that's how it works. That's how it works in the Elections Commission. That's how it works in court.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go to a federal district court and the district judge determines that there's no jurisdiction, and remands it to state court, there's a statute that says that's not appealable. Mm-hmm. It's a finding of no jurisdiction. You can't appeal jurisdiction that they never had.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the person where we say statute of limitations, 10 years, we're not taking this case up, the person's going to be relieved that got yes. the complaint. And the person who filed the complaint maybe is not happy, but they have no standing to do anything mm-hmm. if we didn't go on anyway. So I think it's
they
good.
They don't have any rights at stake. I
no.
mean, they're just reporting something.
Right, mm-hmm. right. They can't force us to go after someone that we don't have the jurisdiction or there's not legal say. So I think we're good with that. The only thing I wanted to mention, because you said that was your last thing, was most of the situations that we get in with employees, like the secondary employment or gifts, mm-hmm. things of that nature, we're not getting in the bribery and the really severe criminal cases because they go to the state attorney's office. The big cases that are violations of the state ethics commission rules go to the state ethics commission. They have investigators. They have a very sophisticated process. We're getting secondary employment, like someone failed to file their secondary employment, mm-hmm. which is a violation. Someone failed to declare a gift to the city or a gift they got in excess of $100. What I found in talking to some of these people over the last 15 years is if you notify them, they immediately crumble, see their whole life flash mm-hmm. before their eyes, and go into immediate tears. And the process that we have of lawyers and probable cause and lots of procedures for this is very heavy for some of the offenses that we get. And what we used to do in federal court is, you know, someone would come in and it clearly, it's like killing a fly with a sledgehammer, we'd have mediation and we'd get them out into, okay, let's just sit you down with someone and talk it through and they say, please, I'll never do it again, let me slip my wrist, I'm so sorry, you know. What kind of effect do we want to get? We might say, okay, here's a letter of instruction, like here's the law, review the law, make sure you never do it again. Okay, thank you. I mean, can we have like a lesser mediation process that we can put people in if it seems appropriate? I think would be good. Federal courts and court, lots of entities have where you divert, it's like a pretrial diversion.
Isn't that the letter of instruction process? We have that.
We're still putting them through the process where we scare them initially. It's scary. It's scary for people, and they think, like, people will call and say, do I need a lawyer? My God, you know, am I going to lose my pension? This is an awful thing. You know, so if before you even file anything, if this committee could approve of maybe this case is appropriate for, like, a pre-procedure diversion or a mediation, it would be a kind thing to do in some cases. It's not as heavy hitting as a bunch of lawyers scaring people. In some cases, I think that's good. Some cases, not so good.
What form do you want that in, Carly? You want that in writing in here, that there is an alternative route?
Before the complaint committee starts to determine probable cause and legal sufficiency, let's say there's legal sufficiency. They did it. You know, it was 3 months ago. There's no statute problem. They failed to declare a secondary employment. They're guilty. We know if we go through legal sufficiency and probable cause, we're going to find it. But is there a procedure before we get into that process of determining that we learn it and we give them a chance to have a mediation on it, perhaps with a letter of instruction afterwards? Mm-hmm. We have letter of instruction in here, but we don't have, like, we're going to stop the procedure. So now they've already figured they have to hire a lawyer.
But the State Ethics Commission, there is a finding, right? Because I've seen 100 decisions by the State Ethics Commission where they say they have to actually find that there is a violation, impose the fine, and then the person comes in and says, please, you know, reduce the fine, and then the State Ethics Commission does it. So
after lawyers, after hearings, after investigations.
But maybe the way for us to do it is we could say, if the investigative panel, the complaints committee, could say, we're going to appoint our advocate, right, if we found probable cause. So our advocate is going to be Kirby or Carla. And before we find probable cause, go sit down with this person and recommend whether a letter of instruction or similar procedure.
Yes, something like that.
But are you even talking before that, Carla? Are you talking about if somebody comes forward and says, look, you know, because I've done this, I want, before we ever have
before,
any of this?
Before we have public records saying that there's legal sufficiency, there's a case you know what I mean? Like, we just divert and we say, we talked with the person, we diverted it, and they had a letter of instruction to read the law and to, I don't know, flog themselves. What punishment, what do we want out of this particular? It's like we now have figured out at the first part of this meeting, the worst case scenario, someone goes all the way through probable cause, they have a hearing officer or an administrative law judge. That's the worst case scenario. That will never happen, but I will, very rarely. What will happen is a whole lot of these people, employees coming in that are shaking, thinking they're going to lose their pension because they forgot to declare their secondary employer, or they got a Jaguar ticket and they thought the value of it was under 100, but it was really over 100 because we don't have intent on this, on our, you know, and so it's inadvertent, it's negligent, and they will now feel like if they're going to be in front of this commission, they have to get an attorney. So we ought to be able to sit down with them and say, don't panic. And, you know, let's work with you on it. We ought to just have the option on the low end. We may never use that. We may never use the one on the top. But at least if we have we're going to have some people that fit into that I think we can save a lot of stress in their life if we have an option.
Probably a lot of stress in our life. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah.
I think we have that.
But really, the punitive measures you're talking about, even if there's a 2-week hearing, and even if there's a magistrate judge,
up to 500.
Right.
Yeah, we're not.
So we're talking about a public record that says there's a finding of an ethics violation, and you were extremely heinous, so it's $500.
But as we learned in the last legislative meeting, that can have serious ramifications on the HR side.
Right.
Yes.
So a finding of violation of the ethics code may result in them losing their job
or demotion
and their pension.
Right.
And their pension.
I mean, a lot of
But I don't see. I think the current rules allow the complaints. I mean, the commission, but under the revised rules, it would be the complaints committee could say, Carla, go sit down with this person and see if you think you would recommend a letter of instruction in lieu of a finding of probable cause.
Well, let's just make it clear in a sentence or two that that's an option. I think you may kind of extrapolate from what we've got that you can do that, but I think it would make it a little clearer that there's.
The complaints procedure thing is a little worse. It has a lot of moving parts.
What do you envision as the procedural mechanism for getting that approval to do a pre-hearing intervention?
I suppose if I see a particular situation, I'd come to the complaints committee and say, I've got this complaint here, and you know, the person accepted a $25 gift from a lobbyist, I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to think of all the different scenarios. Or secondary employment probably comes up more. Or they failed to disclose the gift to the city. but it was for a conference that they were eligible to go to anyhow. And to take them through this whole process, I don't think that this would, it's not good.
So then what, okay, I get that. I get
and then I come to this committee,
right,
and I say, you know, I think that this is one that we can divert from finding legal sufficiency and probable cause and stuff. If you want to put it into, I don't know, like a diversion, you can call it diversion or mediation. I think mediation is a really safe word to use because a lot of people are familiar with mediation. Let's put it in mediation, and then you appoint whoever you want to be mediator on it. And they sit down with that person and say, tell us how this happened. Person cries and tells you, and then you come up with a solution. You mediate a solution, and that's the end of it with the commission.
And, you know, all of that sounds fine. I'm just wondering, how did we get there? You have you have a case where you think it's appropriate for there to be some kind of diversion or mediation.
Yeah.
You bring it to us, then we all vote on it.
Yeah.
And it's what's the requisite determination for it to go on your recommendation to diversion? 2 out of 3 votes?
Well, you could have it with the agreement of the chair of the complaints committee. You could just do it that way, and the chair would divert it, and then we could bring it to the next meeting and say this case came in, and the chair could say, you know, I sent it for the mediation program because it seemed appropriate, and here's why I thought so, and then you guys would, you know, see it. I mean, we could hash out the details. It's just that...
Well, I just think that's a detail that we haven't discussed.
Yeah. Yeah,
maybe important, maybe not.
I think it, under the revisions we talked about, where the complaints chair would have the authority to kind of initiate the informal investigation. Mm-hmm. The complaints chair could also, before this ever gets to the complaints committee, say, Carla, in your initial investigation, you can also sit down with the respondent,
mm-hmm,
and see what proposal do they have, what do they want to do, and then at the next meeting of the investigative body, Carla would have the recommendation and would say, I've done the initial investigation that John authorized me to do. I sat down with the respondent, and I think what we should do is a letter of instruction,
mm-hmm,
and then dismiss it.
And then we
would vote.
Yeah, that sounds fine.
Yeah.
Sounds
good.
I see,
so
really.
You wordsmith that already.
We'll see.
I see when Joe and Kirby and I work on this somewhere, we can get a flow chart. Like, thing comes in, it can either go here, here, or here. And just chart it out so that we know when a person comes in what their options are.
By the time there's a hearing officer, then it just looks like a tree.
I think there's some value in having your wealth of experience and knowledge on these issues, and then an ultimate decision by a neutral body that's,
mm-hmm,
not employed by the city, that is specifically designed to be,
mm-hmm,
separate. So
it's
good. It could work.
It's good, and I can tell you that I don't have any particular need to want to be the final say on it because,
mm-hmm,
I am a city employee, and it's better to say the Independent Ethics Commission appointed by,
mm-hmm,
all of these officials in town came up with this decision.
Mm-hmm.
That's a much better position for me to be in, too.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll draft up something addresses this, but I like it. I like the we're going with it.
Cool.
Okay, we will adjourn the meeting of the complaint committee.